Welcome to The Human Advantage, a podcast from the Center for Army Leadership, which explores the more personal and tactical applications of leadership. In each episode, we meet someone who's experienced the highs and lows of leading, in situations ranging from major combat operations to challenges in barracks. We explore what they've learned about leadership to help our junior leaders prepare for success on operations today and in the future. I'm your host, Ash Bardwaj, a journalist and broadcaster and a British Army Reserve captain with the Rifles. In this episode, we learn how the partnership between officers and non-commissioned officers is vital to the Army's performance.
You need the youth, the ideas, the innovation that a young officer can bring. You also need the stability, the skills and drills and experience a senior NCO can bring. Without change and innovation from the bottom up, the British Army cannot get better.
And how the organisational culture that we create determines the way that people integrate and behave.
I think I joined the army as one person. I think because of the culture at the time, I think I assimilated in something that I thought people wanted me to be, as opposed to someone I was. And I think it's probably taken 15 to 20 years to get back to the Simon who joined the British Army.
Lieutenant Colonel Simon Fairbrother, MC, commissioned in 2001 into the Queen's Dragoon Guards, the QDG. They are a light cavalry regiment that specialises in reconnaissance. Simon served on operations on Op Banner in Northern Ireland, twice on Op Herrick in Afghanistan, and twice on Op Telic in Iraq. His troop was attached to 3 Commando Brigade during the initial invasion of Iraq in 2003, after which Simon was awarded the Military Cross, or MC, for gallantry. Away from regimental duty, Simon was a troop leader at the Army Training Unit in Winchester. He later taught new majors on the Intermediate Staff and Command Course at Shrivenham before attending the Advanced Staff and Command Course himself. He commanded the Army Foundation College Harrogate throughout the COVID pandemic, and is now Deputy Chief of Staff at the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst. Simon had originally planned to join the infantry, so I asked him, why was he drawn to armoured vehicles, and particularly to reconnaissance?
It's a very exciting way of doing business. The reality of infantry is you're often working through corporals to your people and their sections. There is no getting away in the Royal Armour Corps from that crew mentality where, having been trained at Sandhurst for a year and sort of working in a platoon construct, you're suddenly sat next to someone who's probably your age, who's a lance corporal, talking to a driver who's a bit younger than you. And, you know, it's a very intense crew relationship where nicknames are common, but ultimately you're dealing with your people over radio and very directly face to face. And your interaction with other officers is very low, probably over the radio, and you're just there in a crew working together. So I think I reflect back on that time as a crew as a very happy time, living for months at a time with my crew in the desert. Leaving Sandhurst, I commissioned into the Queen's Dragoon Guards, which was exciting. I think, you know, like everyone, you feel like you're joining the best regiments in the British Army. I left Sandhurst and very quickly went into the Formation Reconnaissance Troop Leaders course. But then you go through the stark realization that, you know, Sandhurst builds you up to this pinnacle of becoming an officer, and then very rapidly you're thrown into regimental duty, and rapidly you realize how far at the bottom of the pile you are again. So on joining regimental duty, picked up my first troop. It was 2nd Troop C Squadron. At the time, we always had all of our vehicles, so life was very centered around the tank park. But that gave a real opportunity to be on the tank park and actually get to know your people. As a second lieutenant, yes, you've done the technical training, but you are surrounded by people who have done that for years and years and really do understand what they're doing. And you know, the expression is it takes about 8 years to grow a crew commander on an armored vehicle because they've been a driver, they've been an operator, and then they get to command after 8 years. As a second lieutenant, you're essentially parachuted straight into that command seat, which is why they give you the best operator, probably the best driver, because you're not only commanding that vehicle, you've got the other 3 around you. And it's quite a lot to take on at once.
You talked about the nature of working in a crew. And did that create problems for delivering command and orders, having authority and having respect?
I think that could be a simplistic way of looking at it because giving orders and respect that. That's something that we see as this quite transactional part of being on operations or being on exercise. And the reality is that most of the time it's snap, quick battle orders, you know, especially in reconnaissance. You're up very early in the morning so you can go and recce a route, or you're looking marking a line of departure for the main troops following you. I think the difference in style is really key, and that there is a difference of working through a layer to get to your platoon, vice working directly within that crew. And it's very collaborative. I know a lot is said about the relationship between second lieutenants and their sergeants, be that in a platoon or a troop. You need both. And, you know, the troop sergeant is doing a huge amount in the background to get whatever your plan is in a workable state. And I think probably it takes a while to understand quite how much they're doing in the background, but the importance of the NCO in that relationship cannot be understated.
Can you talk to me about how you ended up going on Optelic? So the initial phase of the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and how you prepared your unit for that?
The regiment had just got back from multiple tours of Kosovo and Bosnia. And I think there was a perception that, well, that's over now. No more medals. You know, we're nice peacetime activity for us. It was a regiment also sort of recovering both psychologically, I suspect, and in doctrine from the end of the Cold War. So all of our training was based around that sort of Red Army opposition, plains of Europe. And that's a very useful vehicle for training. There's no doubt about it, because casualties are high, vehicle casualties, people casualties, all the complexity of war fighting is there. Inevitably, we deployed to Battus for one of our large exercises.
So that's the training area in Canada?
That's correct, yeah. A huge area in Canada, which enabled a brigade to deploy. And this was Exercise Iron Anvil. And I think it was one of the last times we deployed an entire armoured brigade in one place on an exercise. So we were lucky enough to be in this brigade operation, and I was the youngest second lieutenant at the time. The lead officer out there who commanded Battus had a Gazelle helicopter. And an opportunity came up to fly over the range with him in his morning range clearance. And the thing that will always stick in my mind was being able to fly from the back of Battus all the way over the range and see an armored brigade laid out in the field. Not just theoretically, just physically seeing all of the different units, from the dismounted infantry dug in at the rear to the reconnaissance elements at the front, the ammunition compounds, the logistics. It's massive. And that's a vision that's always stuck with me ever since, and I've felt very lucky. But the training itself was tough. It was realistic. If you died, that was you for 3 days. You know, your vehicle was disabled, and you frankly just sat there doing a bit of maintenance and making bacon sandwiches for 3 days until the mission would restart. Phenomenal training. And as it turned out, that's what won the Queen's Union Guards its place on operations. So that was 2002. I think by then it's clear to the nation that war in Iraq is inevitable. And there's a clear sense that we're going to be warned off for operations. Indeed, that happens. And the Queen's Union Guards are selected to be the reconnaissance element for both 7th Armored Division, and that was A Squadron, and 3 Commander Brigade, C Squadron, of which I was a part.
Can you talk to me about the run-up when you started to integrate with the Royal Marines? What did you learn from them? And how did that affect your actual movement into Iraq?
So we deployed to Iraq knowing as a squadron that we'd be attached to 3 Commando Brigade. And it's interesting you say learn from them, because we both learned from them, and I think they learned from us as well. I'm a huge fan of the Royal Marines. I think their ethos is phenomenal. They're an incredibly inclusive bunch. If you're part of the team, you're part of the team, and that's kind of the end of it. We deployed to Kuwait pretty early, actually, in January, and there was a few months to go until anything would actually happen. So it gave my troop that was detached from the squadron and attached to the brigade recce force a chance to just rehearse our skills and drills. It was novel use of light armor. You know, the Royal Marines weren't used to working with what they call tanks. We certainly wouldn't call tanks. You know, the CBRT is a lightly armored recce car. But they very quickly sorted out their logistics so that if one of my vehicles came into contact, they had worked out that a Sea King could lift a pallet of ammunition off HMS Ocean and drop it in a grid square behind us. And they were really rapidly changing their doctrine and understanding of how we worked. Likewise, what was the brigade patrols troop in their mind? It's almost like a tier 2 special forces unit. It's all their mountain leaders. It's all their very best get concentrated into this troop. But they were far more comfortable working on their feet as a unit. And for the first time, really, they were being issued the Wimmick Land Rovers, the weapons mount Land Rovers. And we were looking around their WMX, they were looking around our CDRTs. And my troop sergeant very widely looked at them and said, where's your water? And of course, they were wearing it, wearing webbing, being essentially the Navy's infantiers. And they literally pointed towards their pouch and said, well, it's here. And on the spot, my troop sergeant pulled out a power tool, drilled some holes in their Land Rovers and put a jerry can of water on the side of it and said, there, you've got 5 days. And it just showed that, you know, they, all of the lessons that we had learned about working on vehicles are not apparent to the people who don't. And that was a really symbiotic relationship where we were using HF to talk to each other. We were swapping equipment, swapping vehicles. And over about 2 months, we became a highly integrated part of their team.
What were the actual challenges in leadership when you went from rehearsing in Kuwait into actually going on operations?
So we all had to get from Kuwait to Iraq. For 7th Armored Brigade, that was relatively simple, i.e. they had a berm to cross on land and they would be in Iraq. For us, because the Al Faw Peninsula is surrounded by water, it had to be amphibious, you know, thus the involvement of 3 Commander Brigade. We had rehearsed on landing craft air cushions, or LCACs, amazing pieces of American technology that could take 4 CVRTs on a hovercraft. And right until about sort of 48 hours beforehand, we thought we were going to land on a particular beach, call it Red Beach. That was heavily mined. They didn't want to risk the LCACs. That was called off. We were then put onto the landing craft utilities, essentially those Saving Private Ryan drop front things, and we were floated across quite slow time to land on the Al Faw Peninsula. So the armored vehicles went on landing craft utility, and the remaining Royal Marines were flown in. So we got separated on Boobian Island as we were going over, and we were due to meet up at Al Faw itself with the Royal Marines. We landed on what turned out to be another minefield, extracted from that, got bogged in, it was chaos, eventually got the squadron on land and started moving our way towards the Al Faw Peninsula. We got there and sort of hooked up with the people we'd be working with again. And to my real surprise, Chris Hoare, who was the second in command of the recce troop, was there. And I looked around and I couldn't see Jason, who was the OC. And Chris informed me that Jason, his sergeant major, and one of the signals color sergeants had died on the way in. They had been in Sea Knight helicopters that had crashed on the overnight insertion. And you know, overnight, the way we had trained and prepared had to be changed. He was now in charge. I was working to him. It was a smaller unit. And in many ways, I think that made the troop kind of more critical as an aid to them and another movement. So I think it was a very difficult time, you know, not even in contact with the enemy yet. And we'd lost a huge and very important part of the team.
How did you manage that from a leadership position? Did it mean that you were now having to do a more senior role as well as commanding your troop?
I think it meant that the role of the troop was more important. I think, you know, they absorbed the second in command part themselves and kept me as an independent troop. But certainly I was working directly to the then OC, Chris, rather than via Chris to Jason. So I think we sort of felt that we had taken a step up. But frankly, the focus was on the mission. That whilst it was awful, we had to get on with the mission.
So you went through the Al Faw Peninsula, and a critical moment, a critical battle, was on a bridge. Can you talk me through that and what the consequences were of that for you and for the troop more widely?
Yeah, Operation James was establishing a cutoff on the southeast of Basra so that when 7th Armored Brigade rolled into Basra, there was no way enemy could leak out to the southeast back along the Al Faw Peninsula. So 3 Commander Brigade was tasked with that. And our particular role was to capture one bridge over a river. It had to be captured by 2 in the morning, so everything was done in dark. By that stage, you know, we'd been in and out of contact for a couple of weeks. My GPMG, coaxial, was out of action. My pair vehicles, main armament, 30mm, was out of action, so we had a weapon system between us. But obviously, we were surrounded with the BRF and others. As we were approaching, we had quite a lot of artillery going in front of us, landing on the bridge. It would turn out that those defending the bridge had simply got under the bridge, and so the artillery had done very little. And on approaching to capture the bridge, we were engaged by people with RPGs and small arms from sort of sandbags, bunkers, either side of the bridge. I didn't have a machine gun, so 30mm was the option. That saw off the first bunker pretty quickly. And very rapidly, the engineers and my lead call sign went over to secure the far bank of the bridge. As Corporal Armstrong in my lead vehicle went over the bridge, he was engaged with an RPG which detonated just in front of the vehicle. And most people will understand that CBRT is not designed to take an RPG. He did absolutely the right thing, let off a burst of fire in the vague direction of the shot and reversed out of contact. On doing so, his vehicle went down the embankment of the bridge, and as he pulled up to get back onto the road, he threw a track. And that was a real, oh God, moment, you know, when you realise that you're in contact and, you know, armoured vehicles are totally hopeless when they lose a track. But also, we had practiced splitting tracks, recovering vehicles, roping up, recovering so much, both in the run-up and, you know, training all the way from, you know, from when I left Sandhurst, had sort of prepared us for this moment. I was able to leave my operator in a turret. I could jump out on a headset to him, kind of direct what we could in the ground. With the brigade recce troop, we were able to punch some holes in nearby buildings with our 30 mil so they could get snipers in and provide protection. It kind of all played out the way it should have played out. It was, on reflection, pretty dangerous. There's no question about it. But we were, I would say, quite lucky to recover that vehicle into a safe position and secure that bridge. Ultimately fulfill the mission, which was a great feeling.
And after the end of that mission, after the end of that operation, you were awarded a gallantry medal. What was that like for you? And what was the impact on the wider community of you receiving that medal?
Obviously, quite a few months later, I was pulled into the commanding officer's office on a Thursday afternoon. As a young subaltern, you assume you've done something wrong. Or certainly at the time, you pulled into the commanding officer's office, you thought you'd done something wrong. And he sat me down and said two things. First of all, Simon, you've been awarded a military cross. To be utterly frank, I didn't know what that was. They were relatively rare at the time, and I wasn't a great historian. So I sort of went, oh, lovely. And it took me a while to realise the significance of that, I think. And at the same time, he also said, and by the way, we also want you to go and be a troop leader at ATR Winchester, the training regiment, and you need to be there on Tuesday. Bearing in mind the regiment was in Germany and it was a Thursday, there was quite a lot on. So I was half thinking, isn't this lovely? And half rapidly packing an MFO box to get myself back to the UK. I think my big reflection on this one is I had no chance to go and talk to my team, my troop, about what happened, what the commanding officer had said, because that news was embargoed for 24 hours. And I think I wish I'd had a chance to sort of go and have a beer with them in the squadron bar and talk about it. It's probably my bad for not making that opportunity. And I know that, you know, amongst my troop, there was a real feeling of, hold on, we were all there doing the same thing, facing the same risks, achieving the same mission. Why him? And it probably took about 15, 20 years for that conversation to come out in a bar in London with my driver at the time, who I'm delighted to say is now a late entry officer. And we had a bit of a hug, bit of a cry, and a bit of a heart-to-heart in a bar in London, which was very cathartic. But I think, you know, it's the hackneyed expression that every medal casts a shadow. I think the people receiving often wonder why them. Sometimes the people around them wonder why them, especially when the risks are so apparent to all. But yeah, obviously it's something I'm very proud of, but I also recognise probably represents 40 minutes of what is a 22-year career.
You did go back to Iraq. Can you talk to me a bit about that and what your reflections are on training and the roles of officers and their positioning within physical units and also within the wider society of a squadron?
Yeah, so by the time I went back to Iraq, I was a squadron second in command. You know, very tragically, we lost a friend of ours from another squadron in an IED incident. And I do remember having to hear the news from the commanding officer and the padre about what had happened. And then as Squadron 2IC, you were the patrol master. So very rapidly having to say to that officer's friends, right, get yourselves ready, you're back out again. And at that role of making difficult decisions, sometimes aside from the emotion of it all, because frankly, it's the right thing to do. Very, very difficult times. I think also that readiness at all times to step up. You know, it was supposed to be a six-month tour, and we'd been in various parts of Iraq for that tour in a sort of more peacekeeping role. And I was literally packing my bags at the end of 6 months because I'd got there early when my squadron leader, you know, sadly flipped his Land Rover, causing himself quite a nasty injury on his hand to the point where he simply couldn't be deployed in the desert. So from packing my DOS bag into my MFO to go home, you know, literally someone jumped into my tent and said, squadron leader's down, you need to get out there. And very rapidly, a Merlin helicopter was put on. I unpacked my kit and found myself landing in a desert with a squadron that was about 150 strong at the time and being on operational command as a captain.
What were the challenges of taking on that role as a captain, which is normally a major's job, the next rank up? And also, what was the challenge for leading a squadron that didn't know you in that role?
It is a challenge. It probably is as a squadron 2IC or as a company 2IC, you're closer friendship-wise to the troop leaders or platoon commanders than you are to the squadron leader, who is a staff-trained grown-up, let's be frank. Nevertheless, we did train a lot in those one-up positions on exercise and elsewhere. So landing in, I think I recognised that I was capable of doing it. And I think, you know, the troop leaders there were extraordinarily mature about it as well and realised that we had a month and a half to go and then we needed to get through this as a team. We faced some extraordinary challenges. My great friend Kit hit one of the largest IEDs that had been seen at the time, about 12 to 15 daisy-chained EFPs, explosively formed projectiles, linked up to a passive infrared, very technical device, aimed at a logistics convoy. And because we were on Wimmick on that tour, it flew over most of the squadron's head, but the shock was absolutely massive. They all did a phenomenal job, and I think it's because of the way we train.
So your next operational tour was to Afghanistan on Herrick 9. Can you talk to me about your role there and what kind of cultures you had to deal with?
So we were there to be, a ground-holding battle group to enable the district governor to govern. It was that simple, and support him in doing so. We had a lot of different GAP badges, a lot of different services in one large battle group of over 1,000 people. Battle grouping is a real skill, and it's one that comes naturally to sort of armored infantry and Royal Armour Corps. I would suggest you've got to integrate those units quickly and effectively and get used to the way that each other works. A really good example of that is the operational mentoring liaison team. They were from the rifles, and you know, they weren't quite as used to vehicles as we were. That's just frankly because of their role. There was a massive IED threat at the time, huge devices that were designed to destroy Mastiff armored vehicles. They were getting bigger and bigger, and clearly a Land Rover hitting one of those was catastrophic. We knew from our skills, drills, history, that putting the officer in the lead vehicle is sadly often a bad idea because you need someone to command when something goes wrong. I think very understandably, the rifles officers felt that they had to share the danger with their lead call signs, and they would take it in turns to lead those convoys, sometimes with catastrophic effects. And I think, you know, there was that real balance of how do we encourage them to understand the importance of this particular drill and the reason, however awful, that it's there, vice allowing them to lead in their own way, in a way that was appropriate to their unit.
Officers are often caricatured as these people that are quite separate and remote and naive compared to the soldiers that spent a long time in uniform. What's been your experience of observing that and trying to cope with that?
I don't like the caricature of, you know, the useless officer always getting lost, because I don't believe it's true. You need the youth, the ideas, the innovation that a young officer can bring. You also need the stability, the skills and drills and experience a senior NCO can bring. I think my plea to senior NCOs would be, you know, don't stifle that innovation. Without change and innovation from the bottom up, the British Army cannot get better. So I'd be really keen to say, let them make mistakes. Don't let it be catastrophic, but let them make those mistakes. And you never know, you might learn a little from them. I think likewise to junior officers is listen, but ultimately understand it's your call.
You spent about 15 years in regimental duty before you moved on to other roles. And from speaking to you before this, you kind of went through a personal cultural shift in the way you thought about the army, the organisation, the regiment you joined, and the way the whole organisation was changing.
I mean, the British Army I joined in, you know, the very early noughties was one of emerging from the Cold War. If not actually in belief, it was misogynistic, homophobic, racist in certain terms of its language. So even if people didn't really believe it, the language and behaviours displayed would have made lives very uncomfortable for minorities. And I think I recognised that I was kind of part of that. And it's not something I look back on with any pride. It doesn't change that those units at the time were brilliant at what they did. They were well-trained, they were well-equipped and very effective in war. But we weren't getting the very best out of our people. 15 years of regimental duty, I then started working in a completely multi-cap badge environment of instructing at Staff College. And it gave me an opportunity for the first time to listen to those from other arms and services, and particularly from servicewomen. And I think some of the stories they were telling me about their experience as very senior captains in the British Army, the way they were treated by, in some cases, quite senior ranks, made me pretty determined to then do something about it when I had a chance to do so. So I took over command of the Army Foundation College Harrogate, which is a pretty large organisation. At the time, we had sort of 1,200 junior soldiers and all the staff that enabled that. There was a sergeant who came to me with a survey from the female junior soldiers showing quite how difficult life was. There was my physiotherapy team showing me how much we were injuring our female junior soldiers. And there was just this feel that life wasn't what it should be. So I harnessed quite a lot of my team to sort of do a deep dive into that and understand how we could make life a little bit better. And I'm not saying we solved all the problems at all. And in fact, you know, some of the young women were like, just leave me alone, treat me as a soldier. I just want to be a soldier. They just weren't quite aware that the British Army, if it's allowed to just treat everyone as a soldier, that kind of will be to the detriment of people who need to be trained differently. They have different physiological needs, different social needs, and different psychological needs. And we were making an attempt to do that. It didn't chime with everyone, if I'm honest. I think, you know, that a lot of instructors come from the infantry and, like me, hadn't had the experience of working and didn't understand the challenges. But when you spell out to them about this is just leadership, I had spent 15 years of my career in Iraq and Afghanistan, unable as a reconnaissance soldier to talk to half the population we were trying to interact with because I just didn't have enough women. The only option was to misemploy a dog handler or a medic. Why can't we just have more of those in our own cap badges to do the job, especially in reconnaissance, that we need to do?
So you've highlighted there the benefits of diversity, and then it's about the challenge of actually developing inclusion to make those people part of the team.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a huge, this sounds awful, I'm not a huge fan of diversity as a concept in the British Army, because we actually have very little say, certainly at the tactical level that I was at, about the diversity we receive. It's the way you do inclusion to harness that diversity, which is so important. So it's making the very best of the team you've got. That is the bit that at the junior level, people can do the most about. Diversity is fed to you. Inclusion is something you can actively contribute towards.
So as you're the commanding officer at AFC Harrogate, you were effectively shining a light on cultural and training and behavioural challenges, often in the instructing staff. So you've explained the benefit of their behavioural change, the benefit of generating more inclusion. When it came to actual behaviours, how did you get after them?
Largely by quite scientific measures. I always use the example of sports bras as quite one that makes sort of a lot of infantry corporals and others sort of cringe. But the reality is that a lot of the service women were sort of failing some of the running tests or loaded march tests by a factor of maybe 5 or 10%. And the reality is that if you get a correctly fitting sports bra, that can give the performance optimization you need to make up that gap. So simply as they're very happy to check someone's trainers, are you as happy to make sure that they're wearing a correctly fitted sports bra by just, you know, show us a sports bra, make sure that's on. It's just leadership. And when you sell it as performance optimization, rather than inclusion being just being nice to people to be tried, they instantly get it. And when you get a corporal to understand that they're making someone better and making better operational effectiveness, they go at it.
So as a commanding officer trying to enact this behavioural change, you must have had some pushback. Were people questioning your decisions, and how did you deal with that?
I don't think it was universally popular, but I think as a commanding officer, you do have to say, what is it I'm going to go after? And I think I could have gone into Harrogate and tweaked with the marginal gains of making people better at dismounted close combat. But basic training has been roughly the way it is for hundreds of years, and we keep doing incremental but not sort of revolutionary changes. I genuinely believe that, you know, those changes have never really thought strongly about the needs of service women. So I just felt it was something that I could focus on. And it all pins back to what I'd heard about the lived experience from those captains, and therefore what it must be like for, you know, 16-year-old girls joining the British Army. You know, we are not an institution that looks like it's for them from the outset. They made the most incredible decision to join. And within the first few days, we were unintentionally doing things that were making it look like it wasn't for them.
And in trying to enact those changes, how did you deal with people questioning your choices?
We tried to counter the misunderstanding about what we're doing with as much CPD type activity as we could. We would do focus days, we would do online training. Where it went really badly, you know, you had to use disciplinary or administrative action. There's no question about that. I think probably one of the toughest parts of command is taking disciplinary or administrative action, where you have a really good view of all the facts and you have a close team of your adjutants and your staff assistant and probably your RSM to help you come to a decision. But the wider cohort looking in can't see the rationale behind your decisions. And it could look like bias, it can look like all sorts of things when you can't see what the commanding officer can see.
Were there any particularly difficult periods for you in command where things didn't turn out to be what you expected them to be?
I took command of Harrogate just as the first lockdown was lifting, and we were reintegrating a lot of people into what is geographically quite a small site. And basic training is inherently a social activity that requires hands-on interactions, close proximities, and COVID bit pretty hard. There was a time we were absolutely prioritizing physical safety over psychological safety, which meant that, you know, we were doing the usual stuff of locking people down, isolating people. Now, your average corporal goes in to be an instructor because they are enthused about teaching people to shoot, to run, to fight, to medicate, all those great skills and drills. The reality I had was, well, I was having to lead a cohort. We had about 600 in isolation, 100 locked down, and those corporals were moving from being instructors to care workers. They were literally getting laundry bags for 16-year-olds, fetching food for them, delivering it to the rooms. And I've really felt for them, yeah, because it was really tough work.
And how did you manage that as a leader?
I mean, maybe you'd ask people at the time how well I did, but I think it was just getting across the importance of what we were doing, that despite COVID, the British Army needed recruits. You know, peace or war, you've got to feed from the bottom. So the importance of what we're doing despite COVID was the main rationale. And also that, again, yeah, it was just a different way of leading. You know, yes, you're not doing all the great lessons you want to be doing, but you're looking after and leading and showing an example to these people. You know, it was pretty uncomfortable, but, you know, social distancing, set the example. Wash your hands, set the example. And just say, 99% of them absolutely got it and nailed it. And I'll be forever grateful for those corporals for what they did.
Colonel Simon, it'd be great to wrap up with a few questions. First of all, what do you think that even good leaders sometimes get wrong?
I think as a leader of a team, you're definitely at the top of the pyramid, and there's a seductive nature to therefore always provide wisdom. So when you're leading a team of problem solvers, be that in a sort of regimental O group or planning for operations, the temptation is always then to put the cherry on top. I think there's a danger there that, you know, the team have really built up a really good plan for you. They've come to you with that plan, and it can be quite demoralizing to feel that that plan wasn't good enough. And actually just let them run with the 80% plan. Let them make the mistakes where you can, and then they'll find out themselves. If you're always offering the cherry on top, they'll stop trying so hard because they always know there'll be something not right with it and they have to improve it.
When you look back on your leadership style, how did you evaluate it, and has it evolved over time?
Yes, I think my early troop would say I was probably a bit distant, a bit aloof. It wasn't intentional. I think I joined the army as one person. I think because of the culture at the time, I think I assimilated in something that I thought people wanted me to be, as opposed to someone I was. And I think it's probably taken 15 to 20 years to get back to the Simon who joined the British Army. And that's a really sad reflection. But I'm significantly more comfortable with my leadership now than I was then.
So authenticity is something that you have redeveloped over time. Were there any particular processes that you used to evaluate your leadership style? Were there periods of reflection?
I always found that teaching was when I reflected best, and that, you know, I went through Staff College as a student, and I went through about three times as an instructor, and I probably learned more instructing and learning from those I was instructing and hearing from their experience and taking the time to listen than I had as a student. So I think, yeah, that I'm a huge fan of military education and the time it gives you to reflect on your style and prepare for the next role.
And that seems to be where you developed a lot of your empathy, understanding of others, in order to generate inclusivity, and that aspect of authenticity came through from that.
I think so. I think just, I had just been through my narrow visored career, and opening my eyes to the experience of others and really taking the time to listen actually made me quite angry in a lot of cases, and fairly determined to do something about it where I could.
What do you like to do to relax?
Life's pretty hectic, and I'm pretty comfortable in my own company. So I like to get out and just do something on my own. You know, if I can get out into nature, I actually love deer stalking. Something like that is where I'm happiest. Just peace and quiet, away from the noise. I'm very happy.
Are there any books, podcasts, films, or people that you've learned a powerful leadership lesson from?
I would say if I was to pick one book that really transformed my ideas, it would have been Rebel Ideas, because it just puts down the science of inclusivity and how it, you know, how it's proven to benefit a team. And I think if there was anyone out there who is very cynical about things like teamwork, but considers themselves open-minded, that would be the book to read to understand why this is so important for the British Army in the future.
Is that a Matthew Syed book?
That's correct, yeah, the Matthew Syed book.
And if you were to go back and speak to Second Lieutenant Simon Fairbrother as he was coming out of Sandhurst, or even when he started Sandhurst, what would you tell him about leadership that you know now?
I think it's the understanding that every day you're going to be leading people who are more talented than you are and have better ideas, better experience. It doesn't mean that you're not important in that equation. I think the key is the understanding how you're going to harness that and to delegate to them. That when things go wrong, take the blame. You're in charge. But when things go right, make sure the people who are working for you get that credit. I think that just unlocks so much.
That's a great way to finish. Colonel Simon, thanks very much for taking the time to speak to me today.
Thank you.
It's very powerful listening to Colonel Simon's story because of the breadth of experience he has had in command. Going all the way back to being a troop leader in Iraq in 2003, understanding the importance of working as a team within a vehicle and then integrating with the wider formation you're a part of, understanding the cultures, behaviours, skills and drills of the other teams you're working with, and learning how to collaborate and learn from each other. And then going forward, as he left regimental duty, understanding his own self-evaluation of himself as an individual and of the wider organisation he was a part of, he understood the benefits of having a diverse team, but it was then about getting after the behaviours that were causing problems, and he took that forward into his time as the commanding officer of AFC Harrogate. So really understanding the benefits of evaluating his own leadership style, being self-aware about what he was doing, and then developing followership in those who were implementing his orders to ensure that the cultural change he was after actually happened.
This was an episode of The Human Advantage, presented by me, Ash Bardwaj of Digital Dandy, and co-produced by Feast Collective on behalf of the Centre for Army Leadership. What you hear on each episode are the views of the participants and do not represent the position of the Centre for Army Leadership, the British Army, or the United Kingdom government. Please rate and subscribe to The Human Advantage on your podcast app, where you can find more episodes. If you enjoyed the episode, do send it to any friends and colleagues that you think might appreciate it, and maybe even share it on social media. For more information about developing leadership, just search online for the Centre for Army Leadership. Thanks for listening.